From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on all of the news that made headlines this past week. And today, our panel includes Ian Mack Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, Will Walke, reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau and Wyoming Public Media, Logan Finney with Idaho Reports, Troy Oppie, host of All Things Considered right here on Boise State Public Radio, and Kyle Fastenau, reporter for the Idaho Capital Sun. I want to say happy Friday to everybody.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
So, Logan, let me start with you, because earlier this week, an Ada County judge ruled that two bills that were passed in the legislature last session, which would eliminate the ability for people to use a student ID card for voter registration, that these bills are that they are constitutional. So can you start by telling us about these bills, why they were passed, and then, you know, this legal fight that ended with this decision earlier this week?
Absolutely. So student IDs, as using them for voting purposes specifically, is a topic that has kind of been in the crosshairs of Idaho lawmakers for a while now. And this year they finally took the steps to no longer allow use of student ID cards at the polls, whether you're using them to prove your identity to vote or for registering to vote, for that matter. And that really, for lawmakers, came down to an issue of they're concerned about standardization. You know, if you use your driver's license that's issued through ITD, they verify who you are and what your address is. And the point of view of the lawmakers is a student ID card, depending on if it's from a high school or a university and which university, there's no real way to make sure that they're as secure as a driver's license or a passport or something like that. And so the fact that they removed the ability to use student IDs for voting purposes got a lot of attention during the legislative session this year. And it was part of a larger kind of reform package that they passed that standardized the forms of ID that you can use and the requirement that you have to also prove that you live where you say you live, proof of residence, before you are able to cast a vote here in Idaho. And so a pair of organizations, the League of Women Voters of Idaho, as well as Babe Vote, filed a lawsuit specifically challenging those laws, saying that it was discriminatory to no longer allow use of student IDs for voting purposes. And then, as you referenced, a judge here in Ada County earlier this week ruled that that was not the case and that it was constitutionally okay for lawmakers to no longer allow student IDs.
So, Logan, with this decision by this judge earlier this week, are there next steps in this case? I mean, have we heard from Babe Vote or the League of Women Voters on this?
Yes, actually, as we're speaking on Friday, just this morning, the League and Babe Vote announced that they do plan to appeal this decision. So this will go up to the Idaho Supreme Court to further consider whether the judge ruled correctly in the case.
But as of right now, since we have an election coming up in just a couple of weeks on November 7th, if people are registering to vote right now, Logan, they could not use the student ID, even though these two other organizations have said that they are going to appeal. Is that accurate?
Yes. Yeah, that is right. And originally, this case was scheduled to go to trial next month. I believe that was mid-November, so that would have been after the local elections anyway. And they had asked the court to put a stay on these laws, to pause implementation of these laws while things were going through. But the Secretary of State's office under Secretary of State Phil McGrane filed what's called a motion for summary judgment and asked the judge, from the Secretary of State's point of view, this was a simple enough issue. It didn't necessarily need to go to a full jury trial. And the judge agreed with them. So to directly answer your question, that's right. You cannot use a student ID to vote. But the Secretary of State's office at idahovotes.gov, or Vote Idaho, they changed the website recently, but the Secretary of State's website has a really clear list of the forms of ID that you are able to use, as well as what you can use to prove your residency. In the past, it was kind of up to the individual counties what documents they would accept for residents and whatnot, but now it is fully standardized and it makes it really clear what you can and can't use.
Okay. Ian, speaking of the elections, the mayoral race in Boise is definitely heating up. The candidates are now meeting for debates before the election on November 7th. I know there was a one just yesterday. But can you talk to us about how the issue of abortion came up in regards to whether the city of Boise should take a stance on this issue or not?
Yeah, Gemma. So during the debate yesterday that was hosted by the Boise City Club, the moderator asked a question about how the mayor's office, how the city of Boise should interact with the state legislature, whether the city mm-hmm. should work with the legislature, sometimes push back against it, depending on the issue. And the question was particularly related to women's reproductive rights. And I think this is sort of in reference to a resolution that the Boise City Council passed a while back after the state has implemented, you know, strict laws around abortions. The city basically passed a resolution saying that the city officials would deprioritize those sorts of investigations municipally. And the mayor stood by that, and she said that it's good to work with partners with other agencies, but that the city needs to stand up for, quote, your city values, especially when she said, quote, the state's doing things like criminalizing doctors, criminalizing our daughters, maybe even us if we have problems with our pregnancies. Masterson, however, who's Mike Masterson is a former Boise police chief. He's her most prominent opponent at the moment. He said that he thinks it's a mistake to use the mayor's office to publicize issues that are within the purview of state and national governments. He said that he doesn't think local governments really have a say in those issues and shouldn't really be talking to them or to those issues. He did also say, though, that, quote, I hope we can all agree that women are not safe when politics becomes involved in medicine, and that he thinks the city should sort of more quietly work with the legislature to try to improve women's health care, but that it shouldn't take public stances on those kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm. Were there other highlights from yesterday's debate that stood out to you, Ian? And I ask that because, you know, just weeks away from the election, and this is kind of the first time I think we've really seen the two main candidates, Mike Masterson and Lauren McClain, really kind of going toe-to-toe.
Yeah, absolutely. They talked about a lot of issues ranging from housing to climate change to policing. I think some interesting highlights were a focus on the zoning code rewrite. Listeners may remember that over the summer, the city council passed a huge overhaul of the city's zoning code. These are the laws and regulations that govern what sorts of buildings can be built in different types of neighborhoods, what kind of housing can be built in different places. And the new rules will allow for denser housing along transit corridors, major thoroughfares, as well as denser housing in some neighborhoods as well. And the mayor sort of touted this as an example of what she thinks is needed to build more affordable housing in the city and also to bring people closer to transit, so the transit options, so that the city can improve things like its bus service. And Masterson, her opponent, he said that while the code did need to be overhauled, he doesn't think that really he thought the process was flawed. He says that he thinks the neighborhoods were consulted enough, that the city should have taken longer to do this, to have more conversations with local residents about the plan. So I thought that was an interesting difference in critique that he had of her administration.
Mm-hmm. Well, and such a huge issue, right? I mean, it's something that I think so many people are talking about or impacted by, and so many differing views on how the city should move forward in that end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and another thing I think I'll point out that was interesting is the mayor also talked about her work on building specifically affordable housing. This is something that she's focused a lot of time on. The city, she's used sort of public funds to partner with developers to try to bring more affordable housing online, because she says that while the zoning code rewrite will allow the market to sort of build more units and that'll help with prices, there's a certain subset of really affordable housing, people in the lowest income categories, that the market will not provide housing for, and that therefore she thinks the public dollars need to be spent in that way. And during the debate yesterday, Masterson said that he was sort of opposed to that use of public funds, but I've been told by his campaign today that he actually didn't mean to say that, and that he does support using public funds as long as it's in partnership with other community organizations and private partners.
Okay. Kyle, let's move away from elections for a moment and talk about COVID levels in Idaho. You recently reported on this. We're seeing those COVID levels rise again, even though we have the latest vaccine available. So kind of update us on what's going on and where we're at.
Yeah, thanks, Gemma. So I guess the upshot is Idaho is in an uptick in COVID spread lately, but it is nowhere near as high as huge peaks during the pandemic. Early this week, Dr. Christine Hahn, Idaho's epidemiologist, told me that she likened the current state of COVID-19 to past fall seasons. As surges approached, it's unclear what will happen from here, but she said officials are hopeful that the uptick in hospitalizations has seemed to level off lately. It's worth noting that COVID is landing more people across the country right now in the hospital more than the flu. Experts still say it's worth getting the new vaccine to avoid the inconveniences of isolation and the health woes of serious cases. I guess some quick statistics to measure like where we're at currently to previous stages of COVID. Hospitalizations are up from summer lows when there were about 24 people in the hospital at a time. Right now, on October 2nd, the state's latest report, 62 people were hospitalized. But that's still down from huge peaks in 2022 and 2021, mm-hmm. again, when hundreds of people were hospitalized and hospitals at times warned that they were filling up.
Okay, appreciate that update. Logan, before we take a break, I know you wanted to make a clarification on something on the student ID cards bill that we were discussing earlier.
Yeah, thank you. And also thanks to Sam Sandmeyer, who I believe is listening right now. She's a board member at Babe Vote and texted me to clarify this detail. So the registration and the actual use of voting were two separate bills. So you can no longer use a student ID to register to vote, but the one for actually using them at the polls doesn't go into effect until January. So if folks are already registered, they could use a student ID card at the polls this November.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the clarification on that and appreciate Sam giving you a heads up on that as well so that we are accurate in all of our reporting. So Troy, as we mentioned earlier, Election Day is coming up. It is November 7th. But explain to us how two Boise City Council members have already been reelected, but the election isn't until November 7th.
So this dates to a law passed by the state legislature in 2020 requiring cities in elections with only one candidate and no declared write-in candidates to cancel those elections if there's only one person running. And that was the case in two city council districts for Boise, District 1 and District 6. Those are candidates Lucy Willits and Jimmy Halliburton. It happened in the city of Meridian as well, which is voting by district for the first time. John Overton, who was just appointed to that seat not too long ago after Treg Burnt was elected to the state Senate. Overton did not have an opponent in that race. And so race was pulled from the ballot. So basically, voters in these districts, when they go to the polls, they're not going to see this particular race on their ballot. They'll be able to vote for everything else that would come up, but the district race for city council will not appear. And both Halliburton and Lucy Willits spoke pretty cautiously about this in a recent city council meeting and the council didn't vote on this, to be clear. This was mm-hmm. determined at the clerk level. But they expressed some concerns about, you know, not seeing the name of your elected official at all on the ballot, regardless of if it's the only choice. Here's what Councillor Lucy Willits had to say.
I'm not sure what the legislature intended with this, but I think given that this has happened, you know, in this election cycle and also in Meridian, there will likely be some more conversation about the effects of what this law have done for voters.
And I wouldn't say that it's clear if it's saving any money or even any time, because mm-hmm. the ballots are still getting printed, obviously, for other races. This is probably expected to be a little more common in areas where you've got smaller municipalities and fewer people running regularly. But I would expect that this is going to come up in future legislative sessions. They may revisit this to offer some clarity or at least an option going forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's an interesting point that that Lucy Willits made, though, is that, you know, maybe if you don't see an elected official's name on the ballot, even if they're running unopposed, A, you might not know who is in that seat, or you right. might think that they're not up for re-election. I mean, there's, you know, up for re-election. I mean, there's all of a sudden all kinds of things that or, you know, stumbling blocks maybe that could come up that maybe the legislature, you know, didn't think about when they were looking at it from a cost-saving perspective, Troy.
Yeah, and again, I don't. It's not clear if that move is saving any money. And it was yeah. Halliburton who called it a disservice to the community, and I believe he called it confusing as well.
Mm, okay, appreciate that update on that. I know that happened about a week ago or so, but I'm sure a lot of folks are just hearing about this. Ian, let's stay with elections for a bit because there is going to be a multi-million-dollar measure added to the Ada County ballot come November 7th. So can you fill us in on this?
Absolutely. So the county is going to be asking voters whether they want to asking voters for $49 million in funds to construct an expansion of the Ada County jail. This is something that the Ada County Sheriff's Office has been asking for a pretty long time. The last time there was really an expansion of the bed space and facilities of the jail was in 2013. And the Sheriff's Office says that there's been a lot of growth since then. They say that it's pretty regularly that dormitories at the jail are at or over capacity. Often there are sometimes a few dozen people sleeping on floors in various dorms who've been detained. And so the Sheriff's Office has been pushing for this, and the county is now going to bring it to voters. So this will be a question of basically whether the county can take on debt to pay for this over a 20-year period, and it'll require a two-thirds vote to be approved by Ada County voters.
Okay, so a two-thirds vote. Are any word from the Sheriff's Department on whether they think that this will get that majority?
I don't think, yeah, I don't know that that's known yet. I think they did do some public opinion polling. The county commissioners hired a firm to kind of look at how residents might think about this. And they found that in general, there was support for expanding the jail once it was sort of explained to voters what some of the issues are. But I will say mm-hmm. that the sample size was pretty small and they didn't have a lot of time. The polling firm, that is, didn't have a ton of time to get responses. And so I'm not sure how confident they were in sort of really expanding that out to see what residents think.
Okay. Will, let me bring you into the conversation. So you recently reported and filed a story about backcountry fishing, but how this is impacting our alpine lakes, but also the impact on trout. Fill us in on this.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited to get to talk to you about this. fly fishing it's a really important part of the Mountain West culture and one of the yeah. best parts about fly fishing and experiences that you can have, at least in my opinion, is the ability to take a horse or in my case, just backpack up to really remote high country lakes and cast out a fly in hopes of catching a trout for dinner or just for fun. And this has been a part of Western culture essentially since folks moved out here. And one thing that I didn't know when I started reporting this and that I think a lot of people don't know is that these fish were actually introduced by us humans. In a lot of cases, these lakes were fishless when humans first arrived. And basically starting in the 1800s, humans started introducing trout to high alpine lakes across the West. And at the start, they were doing this by filling milk cans full of fish and tying them to horses or on their backs and doing it. Nowadays, fish and game agencies in Idaho and in Wyoming, where I live, you know, do this by vehicle or in some cases by helicopter. They fly real low over these lakes and just drop fish out of helicopters, which I think is pretty interesting. This is a pretty rapid change in the environment, of course, and it's had impacts, both positive and negative. Positive being we have places to fish, negative you know, towards other species that have been, impacted by this invasive species. And one thing that really interesting that came out, some research from the University of Wyoming showed that this was actually a case of rapid evolution that has happened because we have introduced these fish that were introduced in central Wyoming, basically rapidly evolved physical attributes in their gills to be able to eat their food more efficiently. This is interesting because most people think of evolution taking hundreds, thousands, even millions of years, right? Humans getting the ability to stand up upright. It took us a long time. Well, these fish found ways to more efficiently eat their food in just a couple of decades, basically a human lifetime. And that's pretty unique in the world of evolutionary biology and in the world of scientific research. I just think it's something interesting to think about next time any of your listeners are up in the high country trying to get some fish.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story, Will. So really appreciate that reporting on it for sure. Kyle, so a lot of folks in Idaho have lost access to Medicaid this year because they've been removed from the program. Can you quickly fill us in on that if people aren't familiar with what's going on? But then what can people do if they have actually lost their Medicaid insurance and cannot get back on?
Yeah, thanks, Gemma. Idaho is, after a pause in the pandemic and not evaluating people's Medicaid eligibility, they're now reevaluating whether people are eligible for the program. So since April 1st, they've been processing disenrollment in the program, removing people who were ineligible from the program. And they do that in one of two ways. They will automatically check in their system to see if people have their income updated and find their income and determine if they're still eligible in the program. And if they don't have that information, they can also reach out to people directly through letters in the mail and also through other forms of communication to try to see if you're eligible. Right now, the state, the latest numbers that I've seen were 121,000 people were removed from Medicaid. But the state health department has stressed that if you are removed from Medicaid, say because you didn't reply to the state's request for information and you're still eligible for Medicaid, you can go back and sign up for the program again.
So you can sign up for the program again if you're still eligible. Okay, so for the folks then, Kyle, who are not eligible anymore, what can they do to make sure that they have healthcare coverage?
Yeah, so I believe it was a couple weeks ago, Your Health Idaho, the state's insurance enrollment exchange, which allows tax credits for based on your income, which is the only place you can get tax credits based on your income in Idaho to get health insurance. They announced this special enrollment period, special open enrollment period, excuse me, for anyone who's lost Medicaid this year. So anyone who's lost Medicaid this year, I don't remember the exact date, but they were given a 90-day period where they can sign up for insurance on the exchange. And so far, the exchange says as of a few weeks ago that 30% of people removed from Medicaid had converted onto policies offered on the exchange, which was one of the highest conversion rates in the state. But I think another big question that was still left unanswered is where are folks getting insurance? And we don't know. Some people could be turning to employer-based insurance plans. Some people could be shopping on the private market. We don't know the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at your article that you wrote right now, Kyle, and you reported that if folks are eligible for Your Health Idaho, they do have until November 30th to enroll. That's when that special enrollment period ends. So they still have a little bit of time, it seems like.
Thanks for pulling that up.
So Kyle, tell us about a legal opinion from the Idaho Attorney General's office. This is in regards to how opioid settlement funds are being spent here in our state and what health officials are saying about this opinion and how it's impacting care.
Thanks, Gemma. So the opinion said that opioid settlement funds spent in recovery centers must go exclusively toward people who have issues with opioids. This is an opinion authored August 31st by the Idaho Attorney General's office. Idaho health officials say that the opinion limits Idaho in ways different from other states and would make it more difficult to fund these recovery centers. The opinion says specifically that recovery centers must ensure the funds are going toward people with opioid use disorder. Addiction experts say that the opinion complicates the already difficult job of treating substance use, reducing access to care. That's particularly by requiring treatment centers to ask questions of people coming in. A national expert told me this is a notably strict read of national opioid guidelines, but the head of an Idaho-based treatment center also told me she understood the guidelines to work how the opinion laid it out. So I guess just to back up a little bit more, Idaho estimates receiving about $2 million each year for the state's portion of the opioid settlement funds. Those funds go into three pools. 40% goes to the state, 40% goes to cities and counties, and 20% goes to health districts. We were expected to receive final payments in 2038 in overall, if all settlements go as planned. Idaho is expected to receive $217.8 million.
Oh, okay. And so with that said, though, what are health officials saying in regards to this, to how the money has to be spent? Because wasn't it something about basically other states kind of aren't held to this strict of a standard?
Yeah. So I guess, first of all, health officials say that the full impacts of this opinion are not known, but they say it'll pose significant barriers to fund recovery centers and serve individuals suffering from opioid use disorders and related substance use disorders. One addiction expert put it this way, making it harder to get care makes people less likely to receive recovery services, and it makes treatment more expensive by adding more administrative burden and intakes.
Okay. Appreciate that update, Kyle. Troy, can you talk to us about this? There's a new task force that was just formed, and it is called the Traffic Fatality Review Task Force. Why has this task force been formed? And I guess, you know, the main objectives and goals of this.
So the city elected to form this task force last month, and that follows kind of a string of fatal and serious traffic accidents in and around Boise, primarily car versus pedestrian or car versus cyclist. And the task force is comprised, at least initially, of representatives from the city, from city council, from the mayor's office, local law enforcement folks, the police who investigate serious and fatal traffic accidents, and members of the Ada County Highway District Commission and staff as well. They had their first meeting yesterday. It is, as I understand, the only public meeting that they'll have, because what they're going to be doing is discussing fatal accidents and accident reports, which they want to keep confidential because there's some sensitive information. And certainly anytime you're dealing with something like that, there could be a legal aspect of it that they say they want to protect as well. But they're going to be looking at what could have contributed to these accidents from an infrastructure perspective. So are there... I believe Jimmy Halliburton yesterday called it low-hanging fruit. Are there bushes blocking a viewing of oncoming traffic or a sidewalk or something like that? To signage, to the paint striping on the streets for bike lanes or crosswalks, all these types of things. Is the infrastructure contributing, and can it be changed in those spots to make those types of things safer? They want to... they've talked about bringing in a member of the general public to join this task force. I'm not sure if that will happen. They've also said that, you know, anytime an incident may involve, for example, infrastructure that's kind of used by Valley Regional Transit or a local school, for example, that they might bring in some stakeholders from those organizations to discuss as well. They've kind of modeled this, it sounds like, on a group in Montgomery County, Maryland, that reviews that area's fatal accidents each year and then presents a report to the public on what they're going to change in response to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say, Troy, just anecdotally, I mean, we have a new driver in our family with a permit, and so teaching a kiddo to drive. And I have to say, the thing that has struck me the most is really the number of cyclists and pedestrians, in particular, like, you know, in your downtown areas, that we have. Because when I was learning to drive, and maybe this was similar when you were learning to drive, there just didn't seem to be as many cyclists, as many pedestrians. And so there's so much you have to pay attention to. And it's really something that has just struck me, teaching someone how to drive, that, oh my gosh, I think we've, you know, you start to get used to it, right, as a driver, but then you realize when you're teaching someone, there is just so much you have to pay attention to. But also, I don't know if a lot of motorists really understand, you know, the rules and the laws surrounding cyclists and pedestrians and what we're supposed to do as motorists. So it'll be interesting, I think, to see what this task force does, and hopefully it'll help.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of responsibility, as it should be, on individual drivers to not drive distracted, to know the rules of the road. You know, there are more roundabouts in place now, and I see people who are not necessarily equipped to know what to do when they come up to a roundabout. You know, that's on the driver. But some of the infrastructure decisions about, you know, where to put signage and where to put bike lanes and crosswalks and getting that advanced walk signal, which ACHD says it's going to do across the county at every opportunity now, where the pedestrian crosswalk signal turns go before the light for traffic turns green in the same direction, so that pedestrians can get out and be more visible into the crosswalk before traffic has a chance to go. Those types of changes, that's what this task force appears to be trying to focus on.
All right, appreciate the update on that. So, Will, it is the start of hunting season, because it's the start of fall, so a lot of folks are getting out there, you know, to do this fall activity. And tell us about this app to help people find certain locations.
Sure, absolutely. I think a lot of people think of hunting as a public lands activity. You just go and look on a map and see what federal or state or local parcels you can go to. But actually, a lot of people like to go to private lands. They like to sign agreements with private landowners and pay them a little bit of money for maybe that more less crowded experience. Maybe it's a little bit more one of a kind. And for a long time, that has just been kind of done in an old school way. You know, if I'm interested in going and getting some ducks on someone's land, I say, hey, can I just come by with a wad of cash and set up a blind and do this? And in a lot of ways, that works really well. But actually, there are some new apps. They're sort of using an Airbnb or shopping site model to let prospective hunters find private landowner experiences in their area. And it's sort of a new technology take on, like I said, kind of an old school thing, which is just, I would like to hunt on private lands. From the hunter's perspective, they can find new experiences. Maybe they find a new blind that's not just the same one they've gone to every single fall. And from a landowner's experience, you know, I talked to a farmer in Wyoming for this story, and he gets to market his land and look for a new stream of revenue to maybe a group of people who he couldn't market to before. You know, he's in rural, and now he just gets to put his photos of his blinds and his beautiful flyway of geese and ducks right onto a website, and anyone can find it, come out and visit Goshen County, Wyoming, and go for a hunt. And so there's a number of different apps that are doing this. I profiled one based in Wyoming, but there's a number of apps that are sort of using new technologies to connect more private landowners with recreators. Mm-hmm.
And so, Will, we should say that there are 12 states that allow this in the West, and three of them would include Wyoming, Colorado, and Utah if people are looking for these experiences.
Right, absolutely. And there are some other websites that actually list lands in Idaho. There's one called Land Trust that I believe lists experiences in Idaho. And one thing I'll just say quickly is, you know, a lot of advocates for public land use have said these are the sorts of programs and the sorts of technologies that we should be promoting, you know, because the land ownership pattern in the West is pretty patchwork. There are a lot of public lands parcels, but private lands are very interspersed. In some cases, it looks exactly like a checkerboard. And so connections that we can make between private landowners and folks that like to use public lands gives people a lot more opportunity and a lot more access to have fun and appreciate the outdoors, which is really everyone's goal here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, we are going to talk a little bit about sports, which we don't always do on the roundtable. However, Troy, a lot of folks follow Boise State Broncos football. It's homecoming. Is it? Yes, it is. Okay, so this weekend. So tell us about what's going on in terms of who's going to be quarterback this weekend.
So fans are going to see two. The indication that we have from the coaching staff after they made a quarterback change, not a permanent one, but they pulled Talen Green, who started he started more than a dozen games for Boise State. He started against Memphis, was taken out of the game when the Broncos trailed 28-17 last week, and they stuck Maddox Madsen in there. Coach referred to Coach Andy Avalos calls him Mad Dog. He threw a couple of touchdowns in that game. He has far fewer pass attempts on the year, but his completion percentage is much better than Talen Green's is. Madsen is a bit of a different quarterback too. He's more traditional pocket passer kind of guy. Green is always a threat to take off and run to scramble out if he feels pressure. It's not going to be one guy over the other necessarily, and Coach Avalos, I'm sure couching his words very carefully, says Green hasn't necessarily done anything wrong, but they bring different strengths, and they want to kind of use the different look as a way to keep teams off balance. So it's not clear who's going to come out with the offense for the first offensive play of the game against San Diego State tomorrow, or San Jose State, excuse me, tomorrow. But should be a fairly even split, it sounds like, between Green and Madsen.
Okay, I don't want anyone coming after me on this, but I don't really follow a lot of Bronco football. I'm more of a flag football gal, since, you know, I've got a kid playing flag. But with that said, Troy, what is the how have the Broncos been doing this year, and how much does that play into, do you think, this decision? And we've got about 2 minutes left before I have to take a break.
Yeah, so this decision is kind of locked in on the quarterback play. The coaches, again, said Green didn't necessarily do anything wrong. There are some things that they want him to do differently. He knows what they are. They think he's perfectly capable of that. But it sounds like they're just trying to maybe give the offense a bit of a jump start. They had a couple things go sideways in that Memphis game, of course, that put them behind the eight ball a little bit. But Ashton Gentry, the running back, has just been terrific so far this year. And offensively, they've really leaned on him for a lot of the production. So, I mean, I am interested to see. I don't think it's going to look so different offensively with two quarterbacks. There's simply not enough time to completely change what you're doing from week to week in a college football season. But I think you are going to see some kind of unique aspects of the offense going forward. Bush Hamden, in his first year as offensive coordinator, now back with the team, the former quarterback, he was Kellen Moore's backup for a number of years.
Oh, okay. All right. So the game is tomorrow at Bronco Stadium. I want to thank all of you for your time today. Really appreciate it, and all of the updates as well. So big thanks to Ian Max Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, Will Walkie, reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau, as well as Wyoming Public Media, Logan Finney with Idaho Reports, Kyle Fallensteel, reporter for Idaho Capital Sun, and our very own Troy Oppie, host of All Things Considered, right here at Boise State Public Radio News. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, we're taking center stage. Introducing NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of Black-led stories from NPR's podcasts. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.